Autumn Shadows in August by Robert W. Norris. Copyright 2006, Robert W. Norris. Read by Robert W. Norris. If you would like to order a PDF download or trade paperback copy, go to www.lulu.com/Robert Norris. Autumn Shadows in August is also available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other online bookstores. Chapter 10. 2 days later, we were on a crowded and noisy Eurostar bound for Rome. We passed through numerous tunnels and rolling farmland dotted with buildings bleached by the Mediterranean sun. When we arrived at the central train station in Rome, there was a bit of confusion figuring out how to get to the American Anglo Hotel, but we managed to find the metro and get off at the Barberini stop, which was a short walk from the hotel. Cowardy wasted no time in finding out from the front desk clerk what tours were available. There was one that evening, and the bus would stop near the hotel. We opted for it. The tour guide struck my interest from the moment we got on the bus. He was short and immensely sad-looking, with deep eyes, lines of weariness etched on his face, and a goatee. He was wearing shabby clothes. He was in his mid-40s and looked quite fragile, like an altar boy. He spoke 4 languages, English, German, French, and Italian, and kept up his narrative in all 4 for the 30 or so other tourists who joined us. He said his main job was teaching literature, and during summer breaks he worked as a tour guide. Our first stop was at the Trevi Fountain. The crowd towered above our tour guide, but he held our attention thoroughly with his ironic speaking manner, patience, and kindness. We placed our faith in him and followed him obediently. At the fountain he held his hands together like a priest at prayer and said, "If you toss 1 coin in the fountain, you will have 1 wish come true. 2 coins and you will get married. 3 coins and you will be divorced." It was a clear night with a near full moon. All the monuments we passed were well illuminated. At one point, after the bus crossed the Tiber and was cruising along the road parallel to the river, the tour guide said, "Here on the right you can see the Justice Building. It is being cleaned right now. The building is always half clean, half dirty, like justice itself." Everyone laughed. When we stopped at the Piazza Navona for a 30-minute break, I lingered behind the others in our group so I could talk to this man. He seemed to possess an artistic soul. "Are you teaching at a university?" I asked. "No, at a high school." "It must be difficult working 2 jobs." "There is no school in summer, but yes, it is difficult." The tour guide put his hands in his pants pockets, shuffled his feet, and looked mournfully at the ground for a moment. "I also teach at a university in Japan." The tour guide's eyes rose to meet mine. "Do they pay you well?" he asked tentatively. "It's a good salary, I think. I worked for many years with terrible salaries, so compared to that time, it's more than sufficient for me." "They pay very little here in Italy. I must work this job to help feed my 4 children." "Do you also write?" His eyes lit up. "Oh, yes, yes, it is my one passion. The thing that keeps me alive. Oh yes, literature is my great love." I seemed to have gained his trust, so I asked, "What have you written?" "I have published 1 novel and a book of poetry. Unfortunately, there is no money in writing, particularly in writing literature or poetry. But that is the way life is for artists. They must suffer to produce their work. I know this. What I really want to write, though, is my life story." "Is that so? If you don't mind, I'd like to hear a little of your life story." He looked at me pensively for a moment, then said slowly, "Well, I hope I do not offend your sensibilities, for my life story contains a good amount of criticism of my country and religion." "That's no problem for me. I was a conscientious objector to the Vietnam War and spent time in prison for refusing my country's orders. I also have many disagreements with politics and religion the way they are practiced in the U.S. I think any good artist has a responsibility to criticize the society he or she lives in. I'm probably about the last person in the world you need to worry about." Thank you for understanding. You see, I was taken away from my family at the age of 11 to serve in a monastery and become a missionary. My dear friend, you cannot imagine the power the Catholic Church possesses and how it can ruin people's lives. I was made to suffer greatly. Some of the elders at the monastery did unspeakable acts to me. A look of deep anguish passed over his face. He looked down at the ground for a moment. Then he looked up and directly into my eyes and said, "You have no idea what they did to me, how they made me suffer. I suffer still because of those experiences. And it was not I alone who suffered these things. It is endemic within the system itself. These dark secrets of the church and state must be told. I must be brave. I must write my life story to tell people about the terrible things the church does to young boys. But it is very difficult, and I must work to feed my family." "It must also be difficult in your job here when so many tourists are asking questions and taking pictures and gasping in awe at the symbolism of Rome's power and its religious history," I said. "Yes, it is difficult, but sometimes I can criticize without fear. I've also done some writing, nothing on any magnificent scale, but I've had 2 novels and a novella published. One of the books was quite critical of the American government in the Vietnam War." "I have done some study of psychology, and I knew you were different," he said. "Really? You took notice of me when I got on the bus?" "Oh yes, I noticed something about most of my guests. I thought perhaps you had suffered some time in your life, too. There's a certain aura about you." One of the other tourists had returned and now interrupted with a question. The tour guide gave me an apologetic look, excused himself, and turned his attention to the other man. I wandered off to join Kaori. At the end of the tour, as our tour guide departed the bus, he looked at the group with a sad smile and said, "Thank you all for listening to my humble stories. Good night and enjoy your holiday in Rome." I felt a sudden desire to shake his hand and say goodbye personally, but I hesitated too long. I had to wait for a few other tourists to get off the bus ahead of Kaori and me. I looked around, but all I could see was a man in the distance, walking down the street. I closed my eyes hard and willed him to stop. In my head, I hobble after him and shout, "Hold on a second!" He stops and turns around. As I draw closer to him, I notice he looks slightly different from a few minutes before.
"Fooled you, didn't I?"
he says and flashes me a large grin. For a moment, I am stunned. "Mr. Lowry, is it you?" He grabs his sides and lets loose with a boisterous laugh, followed by another of his coughing spasms. He has to hold his hands out and brace himself against me to keep from collapsing. I hold him up firmly. "Are you okay?" His coughing subsides and he draws in several deep breaths.
"Dreary me," he says. "That was nearly my last breath. I'm okay now."
He steps back, then strokes his goatee, looks at me impishly, and says,
"This was a nice touch, don't you think?"
I laugh and say, "Yes, it was. You really had me going. I believed everything you said. You had all my sympathy and fellow feeling. I was convinced of the whole story."
"Well, it's all true, at least cosmically. I'm like Fyodor, sicka in the head."
He points to his head and grins.
"I can take on the persona of any artist who has suffered, you see. The tour guide is just one of many. I was raised among Methodists and Anglicans, but from my Mexican experiences, I have a special feeling for the Catholics and their own forms of suffering."
"So what have you been doing since Amsterdam?" Lowry hitches up his pants, shrugs, and puts a shaking hand on my shoulder.
"I've been to Sicily, and am now on my way to England. For Marjorie, you see, she can get free treatment for her strep throat. She also wants me to see a psychiatrist."
Lowry breaks into a mock southern accent and says,
"I can stand anything. Ain't nothing wrong with me that a good boar bone won't cure."
He winks at me, then says in a normal voice,
"That's a line from Faulkner, you know. Perhaps you and your wife can come and we can live near one another and discuss work in progress."
"That would be nice, but I don't know. We'll be going back to Japan soon."
"It's a pity," he says, withdrawing his hand and wobbling for a moment. "Have you been to Sicily?"
"Yes, back in 1973, but just for a few days on the beach at Cefalù." Lowry straightens up and with an air of mock seriousness says,
"Well, in my humble opinion, sir, it is the worst and most hypocritical place in the world, and the most hopeless. They know neither how to live nor how to die. Bloody hypocrites who deliver endless lectures about drinking their bloody wine even while overcharging you for it. I agree completely with D.H. Lawrence, who put a malediction upon the whole place."
He pauses for a second, then says,
"Granted, there is a stern beauty in their culture."
We stand awkwardly for a moment. I don't know what to say. Then Lowry hacks up a ball of phlegm, spits it out, and with an air of grave seriousness says,
"So, did you read the book I gave you?"
"Yes, I did."
"And did you see any similarities between yourself and Harry Haller?"
Lowry peers at me as if my life depends on my answer. I think for a moment. "Well, some, I suppose. I don't see myself like Harry in the early parts of the story when he is the ultimate loner, aloof and scornful of bourgeois culture and contemplating suicide. I don't believe I've ever been as misanthropic as he was." I shift my weight and scratch my head. I have, however, been questioning the validity and meaning of my life, but I don't feel isolated from humanity. Maybe intellectually and emotionally isolated from America, but not humanity.
"Yes, I see. Go on."
A different, more gentle and compassionate expression marks Lowry's face. "I connected more strongly with Harry after he went to the Black Eagle and met Pablo, the saxophone player. It's strange that that head shop in Alkmaar was called the Black Eagle, and the owner's name was Pablo, too. He gave me some mushrooms and a chess game to play variations of my life with."
"Yes, yes, I know all that. Don't you remember?"
Lowry slaps my side.
"Pablo gave me the book to give to you. It's all part of the cosmic connection, my man. I thought you would find a connection in that part of the story."
"Yes, well, I could relate to Pablo's giving Harry hallucinogens that push him onto the road to building alternatives to his life, especially the idea that there isn't just one reality to embrace, but rather there are many possible realities, each approaching something, but never quite escaping the self."
"And what precisely does this realization mean to you?"
"If I can say anything, I suppose it's that Hesse's writing challenges me to face myself more honestly, to recognize the distortions in the reality I've created for myself. He challenges me not to take myself so seriously, and to learn to even laugh at what I often perceive as suffering and frustration. When I can laugh, I somehow come into a closer reality to the world in which I'm actually living. That makes that life much more possible and positive, even in a world that ultimately doesn't matter. But these thoughts and realizations have always surfaced whenever I've taken hallucinogens. I just haven't taken any for a long, long time. I can't say that reading Steppenwolf alone has caused me to experience a sudden epiphany. At any rate, my old self now seems more like a distant fragment of memory. Thank you, anyway, for turning me on to the story again."
"That's good enough for me. The main point is that you can laugh at life and not take yourself too seriously. Have some fun."
Lowry grins widely.
"And now it's time for me to find the next drink. You know, I will start aversion therapy soon and must be prepared. And I must get back to Marjorie. She's no doubt worried about my latest disappearance. She always wanted a child, and I suppose that's what I've become."
Lowry sticks his trembling hand out and we shake hands. He looks suddenly very old, and for a brief moment his eyes roll back in their sockets. He takes a deep breath, refocuses, and says,
"Keep laughing, my friend. To suffer is to be alive, and life is the voyage that never ends."
He abruptly turns around and, walking in a zigzag line, heads down the street. I watch him until he disappears. Coward and I returned to our room. I stretched out on the bed and watched her write down in her notebook everything we had done and seen all day. Books, maps, and various notes written on scraps of paper were spread out on the table in front of her. Cowardy looked up for a moment and said,
We covered a lot of ground today, didn't we?
That's for sure. I was very impressed by our tour guide. Thoughts of both the man and my vision of Malcolm Lowry crossed my mind.
Me too.
He was great at his job. He listened intently to everyone's questions. He obviously cared about the group. I really liked his gentle manner. You know, it would take years to cover all of Rome in order to know it well, but I feel I learned more about Rome in these last few hours than if I could actually spend years living here. Cowdy smiled at me and went back to her work. Early the next morning, we confirmed our plane tickets back to Japan, went to the central train station and bought train tickets to the airport for the following day, and headed to the Vatican for a tour of the Vatican Museum. It was another cloudless, hot day. After the tour, we walked to St. Peter's Square, sat down in a shaded area, and stared at all the statues atop the massive pillars.
"It's been an amazing trip, hasn't it?" Cowardy said.
"It sure has, but Rome is a bit too much for me."
"A bit too much?"
"Yeah, maybe that tour guide story last night is still stuck in my head. But I get a bad feeling about the overwhelmingly huge scale of everything, the ostentation of it all, the way the Catholic Church glorifies itself. It's just too much. Buddhist humility is much more attractive to me. At any rate, at least we can now say that we've seen the Sistine Chapel and the greatest of Michelangelo's works."
"That we can. But I'm a little sad, too, that our trip is coming to an end. I've learned a lot of things on this trip."
"What kind of things?" I asked.
"Oh, things about art and history and life and death, and myself, too. I've even learned a little about people's prejudices."
Cowardy sighed, looked in the distance, and returned her gaze to me.
"Living in Japan, I never think of it so much, but here in Europe, I'm often the only one with an Asian face, and I've sometimes felt people looking at me in a condescending way. Sometimes some of the clerks in shops have looked down at me, and sometimes they tried to cheat me on prices. I've heard their prejudice in the words and tone of voice."
A sad look appeared on Cowardy's face.
"Really? When?"
"Oh, for example, in Amsterdam a few times on the street, someone said to me, 'Hey, China!' like I was a prostitute or something. Once on the phone in Basel when I was trying to get some information, the clerk said very impatiently, 'I can't understand you.' In some of the shops in Florence and Rome, I felt people looking down at me, and I wanted to say something harsh to them in English, but I couldn't think what to say." Cowardy took a deep breath and sighed again, this time more audibly. "I feel a little sad, too, like the past is falling away from me and I'm losing something." I patted Cowardy on the back and squeezed her shoulder. "I do think you've done a tremendous job communicating in English."
"I don't mean to sound like everything has been negative. Almost everything has been positive, in fact. I just get frustrated sometimes because I can't speak like a native speaker. I felt more deeply than ever how important my English study is. I'm so happy I've been able to make friends with people like Undine. If I hadn't studied English so hard for all these years, I could never have known them. Many people have been kind to me. I'm always asking them 100 questions, and they do their best to help me."
Cowardy took my hands in hers.
"Most of all, though, is I've learned how important you are to me, and how much I love you, honey-chan. I think I understand you better now and have a better idea of what you were like when you were young and how you came to me after all your many experiences."
She looked me straight in the eyes for a moment, smiled, and said,
"Are you happy with me? Do you really love me?"
"Of course I do. I've realized more deeply on this trip how important you are to me, too. I've enjoyed watching you and your excitement more than anything else." We squeezed hands, then Cowardy laughed and said,
"Really? You've been watching me? We do make a great team, don't we?"
"That we do."
"You know, maybe the most important thing I've learned is that we have to live life right now, every moment. Each moment is too precious to take for granted. We can't worry about yesterday or tomorrow. All we have is right now, and we should appreciate it fully and give everything to it we can, because it can all disappear so quickly."
"Amen to that," I said. "I'm really happy to be here right now with you." We both looked wistfully into the distance. In a sense, this journey had been an attempt to re-enter my past. understand it fully, then at least distance, if not completely separate myself from it. Now that separation seemed nearly complete. So what was there to look forward to in the future? Cowardy was right. The important thing was to hang on to each moment as if it were our last. Still, there was that persistent, nagging feeling that the remaining moments would soon be gone. Our shadows were stretching longer right in front of us. Emotion thickened my throat. I felt a sudden, urgent need for Cowardy's forgiveness. "You know, Cowardy?"
"Yes?"
"I'm sorry for all the bad things that have happened to us."
"I am too, but you don't have to say that."
"I know, but I just wanted to let you know that I wish I could have made things better in some ways. I'm sorry we couldn't have children."
"It wasn't your fault."
Cowardy reached over and stroked my cheek. "But you had to suffer for that, much more than I ever did. I'm sorry you had to go through the pain of cancer. I'm sorry for not always being a warm husband." Tears ran down Cowardy's face. She put her arms around me and we hugged tightly. Muffled sobs broke from both our mouths. We choked them down and pulled back to look at each other.
"I'm sorry you have hepatitis, and I'm sorry for all the pain in your life, too."
"I love you very much, Cowardy. I want to spend the rest of eternity with you."
"You make me so happy."
We embraced again, and the dams burst. The following morning, our last of the trip, we took a walk along the ritzy Via Vittoria Veneta and looked at the window displays of the many leather, jewelry, and fashion shops. We took a side street and found ourselves on the Via Lucullo. We passed by a large Italian labor union building. In front of the building was a massive sculpted bronze plaque, poignantly depicting a laborer bound with rope around his waist and wrists and a yoke around his neck. The laborer was lying in agony on the floor, silently and tragically suffering for the cause of liberty. Next to the man was a small bowl containing a meager portion of gruel. We stopped and stared silently at the suffering laborer. I turned to Cowardy and said, "There's some powerful symbolism in this sculpture, don't you think?"
"Yeah."
"In a strange way, it even reminds me of our own lives."
"What do you mean?"
"The way this man is struggling to break free is like us trying to break free from the bonds of our own illnesses."
"I think I've already broken free."
Cowardy took my arm in hers.
"That's all I thought about for a long time after my operation. I couldn't move, mentally, physically, or emotionally. I couldn't think of anything else except my cancer and death. But I've graduated from that, and I love every minute of my life now. And I love every part of our relationship."
We headed slowly back toward the Via Vittoria Veneta. My ankles were sore again, so we stopped at one of the glass-enclosed outdoor restaurants and had an expensive cup of coffee. Across the street was the church of Santa Maria della Concezione. I'd heard about the Capuchin crypt, which was inside the church and contained the bones of 4,000 Capuchin monks. I wanted to see the place. We crossed the street and knocked on the church door. We had to wait a few minutes before an elderly monk in a brown frock came to the door. His skin was pale, but his eyes were a bright blue. With a stiff wave, he directed us to a winding stairwell that led to a small, dark chamber. Near the entrance was a small wooden table on which was placed a box with some candles. I picked up one, put it in my pocket, and entered the chamber. As our eyes gradually grew accustomed to the dim light, we saw two robed skeletons reclining in an archway made of neatly arranged skulls. Smaller bones were arranged on the walls and vaulted ceiling in intricate patterns and piles. Even the small fluorescent lamps casting eerie shadows were made from bones. I sucked in my breath. We continued along a narrow hallway to the other chambers. I was in Malcolm Lowry's realm once again, and a continuous thought ran through my brain. "Dark is the grave wherein my friend Thomas and the Capuchin monks are laid." Bones were everywhere. They covered everything, every surface, and in every design imaginable. We came to the final chamber. Two severed arms hung on the far wall. Plastered into the ceiling and done in meticulous detail, a carefully crafted figure of the grim reaper stared down at us. Its face was a human skull.
In one hand it held a scythe, the blade made out of a descending column of bones that tapered into a sharpened edge. In the other hand it held a set of scales, also made out of bones. Nearby was the face of an ancient clock with Roman numerals, formed from more bones, that seemed to tick away man's time on earth. A sign on one wall read, "What you are now, we used to be. What we are now, you will be." A multitude of thoughts and images clamored for my attention. Was this what all those various omens and signs on the trip had been leading me to? A stark, morbid reminder of the vanity of my own ego, of my own imminent demise and that of every soul who had ever crossed my path? No, I rejected that thought. There was more to it than that. I thought back to my Amsterdam mushroom journey and tried to recapture the connection I'd felt with the cosmos. The images of the characters in those vignettes, the many characters in my chess games, paraded again in a flash across my mind. I thought suddenly of Malcolm Lowry in Oaxaca finding out at the Banco Ejidal about Juan Fernando's murder and saying, "He gave me his friendship and advice I will use the rest of my life, and he is dead like that." Just like I felt about Thomas in Amsterdam when I learned of his death. Later that day, Lowry and his wife entered a small, dirt-floored Oaxacan church, where they knelt and he prayed that the Virgin Mary would hear his prayer and in some obscure way protect Juan Fernando's soul. Lowry had also seen in the church a man in supplication, a woman and her child with their hands outstretched, and a drunk huddled asleep in a dark pew. At the church door on the way out, Lowry paused once more in front of his personal saint, the saint of desperate and dangerous causes, and said another prayer, this time for the man in supplication, the woman and child, the drunk, the bank manager who had told him about Juan Fernando's death, his wife, himself, and indeed the entire world. I got down on my knees and prayed too. I uttered silently the names of Cowardy, Thomas, "You are my better thing, man," Undine, Pablo, the concertina player in Basel, the busted teenagers at the Swiss-Italian border, the sad tour guide, Damien Riley, all the military prisoners I'd known, Peter the German drifter in Cefalu, Harrison Gant and Tommy Edwards and Gary Minch and all the lost Vietnam vets including those 200,000 who had returned from the war and committed suicide, Hassan and Ataola, the untouchables of India, the plump Pakistani hotel owner, the Japanese softball team members and all the local residents who had been so kind to me, the Kobe earthquake victims and their families, all the laborers of history represented by that sculpture Cowardy and I had just seen, and, yes, the entire world. I felt Cowardy's hand on my shoulder. "Are you okay?" she asked. "You have a strange look on your face." I stood up gingerly. "Yeah, I'm okay. I just felt the need to say a little prayer." "This place is too creepy for me. Shall we get out of here?" Cowardy put her arm in mine, and slowly we began to ascend the steps out of the subterranean chamber. Midway, I stopped and told Cowardy, "Hold on. There's one more thing I have to do. I'll be back in a minute." Cowardy looked at me strangely and said, "Okay, I'll wait here." I returned to the Grim Reaper. I reached in my bag, pulled out the chessboard and all the pieces, and arranged them carefully next to some of the bones on the floor. I then took the candle out of my pocket, lit it, dripped some of the wax on the chessboard, stood the candle in the wax, and lingered for a moment thinking, "For you, Thomas, one candle burning in my own Temple of the Virgin for those who have nobody them with." On the way out of the church, I dropped some money into a donation tray. Outside, I took a deep breath of fresh air. Fresh air, new life. And put my arm around Cowardy. She snuggled closer, looked up at me, and asked, "What were you doing back there?" "Oh, nothing much. Just burying some old baggage from the past." The end. About the author. Robert W. Norris was born and raised in Humboldt County, California, where he played basketball in high school and junior college. In 1969, he entered the Air Force,
subsequently became a conscientious objector to the Vietnam War, and served time in a military prison for refusing to fight in the war. In his 20s, he roamed across the United States, went to Europe twice, and made one journey around the world. During that time, he worked as a mill hand, construction laborer, stevedore, mailman, baker, saute cook, and oil rig steward. Norris has lived and taught English in Japan since 1983. He has an M.A. in teaching English as a foreign language from Newport University in Newport Beach, California. He is the author of Looking for the Summer, the story of a Vietnam War conscientious objector's adventures in search for identity on the road from Paris to Calcutta in 1977, Toroware, a novel about the obsessive relationship of three misfits from different cultural backgrounds in 1980s Kobe, Japan, and The Many Roads to Japan, a novella used as a textbook in Japanese universities. He has also written several articles on teaching English as a foreign language. He and his wife live near Fukuoka, Japan, where he is a professor of English at Fukuoka International University. Check his homepage at http://www2.gol.com/users/Norris/.